scene, as if the new medium had made of everybody a writer. I'm typing this just by the window, looking out the blue-grey sea where three girls are diving into the water. But my mother never emailed that way. She got the hang of it at once. And when I was only a few weeks out of college, but still by that blue-grey sea, she began sending me multiple two- or three-line messages a day, mostly unpunctuated, and always with the sense of something written at great speed. They all had the same subject. When was I planning on coming back? She didn't mean to the old estate. She had moved on from there the year before. Now she lived in a pretty ground-floor flat in Hampstead with the man my father and I had taken to calling the noted activist, after my mother's habitual parenthetical, "I'm writing a paper with him. He's a noted activist. You've probably heard of him. He's just a wonderful, wonderful man. We're very close. And of course, he's a noted activist." The noted activist was a handsome Tobogonian of Indian heritage with a little Prussian beard and a lot of sweeping black hair dramatically arranged on top of his head, the better to highlight a single grey streak. My mother had met him at an anti-nuclear conference 2 years before. She had gone on marches with him, written papers on him, and then with him, before moving on to drinking with him, dining with him, sleeping with him, and now moving in with him. Together they were often photographed, standing between the lions in Trafalgar Square, giving speeches one after the other, like Sartre and de Beauvoir, only far better looking. And now, whenever the noted activist was called upon to speak for those who have no voice, while on demonstrations or at conferences, my mother was more often than not by his side, in her new role as local councillor and grassroots activist. They had been together a year. In that time, my mother had become somewhat well-known. One of the people a line producer on a radio show might call and ask to weigh in on whatever left-leaning debate was happening that day. Not the first name on that list, perhaps, but if the president of the Students' Union, the editor of the New Left Review, and the spokesperson for the Anti-Racist Alliance happened all to be busy, my mother and the noted activist could be counted on for their near-constant availability. I did try to be happy for her. I knew it was what she'd always wanted. But it's hard, when you're at a loose end yourself, to be happy for others, and besides, I felt bad for my father, and sorrier for myself. The thought of moving back in with my mother seemed to cancel out what little I had achieved in the previous 3 years, but I couldn't survive on my student loan much longer. Despondent, packing up my room, flicking through my now pointless essays, I looked out to sea and felt I was waking from a dream, that this was all that college had been for me, a dream, placed at too far a distance from reality, or at least from my reality. My rented mortarboard was barely returned before kids who had seemed not so different from me began announcing that they were leaving for London right away, sometimes heading to my neighbourhood or others like it, which they discussed in derring-do terms, as if these were wild frontiers to be conquered. They left with deposits in hand, to lay down for flats or even houses. They took unpaid internships or applied for jobs where the interviewer happened to be their own father's old university pal. I had no plans, no deposit, and no one who might die and leave me money. What relatives we had were all poorer than us. Hadn't we been the middle-class ones in aspiration and practice? And perhaps for my mother this dream was the truth, and just by dreaming it, she felt she had brought it to pass. But I was awake now, and clear-eyed. Some facts were immutable, unavoidable. Whichever way I looked at it, for example, the £89 currently in my current account was all the money I had on this earth. I made meals of baked beans on toast, sent out 2 dozen application letters, waited. Alone in a town that everyone else had already left, I had too much time to brood. I began to look at my mother from a new, sour angle. A feminist who had always been supported by men, first my father and now the noted activist, and who, though she continually harangued me about the nobility of labour, had never, as far as I knew, actually been gainfully employed. She worked for the people. There was no wage. I worried that the same was true, more or less, for the noted activist, who seemed to have written many pamphlets but no books, and had no official university position. To put all her eggs in the basket of such a man, to give up our flat, the only security we'd ever known, to go and live with him up in Hampstead in exactly the kind of bourgeois fantasy she had always bad-mouthed, struck me as being both in bad faith and extremely reckless. I went down to the seafront each night to use a dodgy phone box that thought 2 pence coins were 10s and had many ill-tempered conversations with her about it. But I was the only one in an ill temper. My mother was in love and happy, full of affection for me, although this only made her more difficult to pin down on practical details. Any attempt to delve into the precise financial situation of the noted activist, for example, got me fudged answers or a change of subject. The only thing she was always happy to discuss was his 3-bedroom flat, the one she wanted me to move into, bought for £20,000 in 1969 with the money from a dead uncle's will, and now worth well over a million. This was a fact which, despite her Marxist tendencies, evidently gave her a huge sense of pleasure and well-being. "But, Mum, he's not going to sell it, is he? So it's irrelevant. It's not worth anything with you two lovebirds living in it. Look, why don't you just get on the train and come for dinner? When you meet him, you'll love him. Everybody loves this man. You'll have a lot to talk about. He met Malcolm X. He's a noted activist." But like a lot of people whose vocation it is to change the world, he proved to be, in person, outrageously petty. Our first meeting was dominated not by political or philosophical discussion, but by a long rant against his next-door neighbour, a fellow Caribbean who, unlike our host, was wealthy, multiply published, tenured in an American university, owned the whole building, and was presently constructing some kind of fucking pergola at the end of his garden. This would slightly obscure the noted activist's vista of the heath, and after dinner, as the June sun finally went down, we took a bottle of Ray and Nephew, and in an act of solidarity, stepped into the garden to glare at the half-built thing. My mother and the noted activist sat at their little cast-iron table and slowly rolled and smoked very poorly constructed spliff. I drank too much rum. At a certain point, the mood turned meditative, and we all gazed over at the ponds, and beyond the ponds to the heath itself, as the Victorian lamplights came on and the scene emptied of all but ducks and adventurous men. The lights turned the grass a purgatorial orange. "Imagine 2 island kids like us. 2 barefoot kids from nothing, ending up here," murmured my mother. And they held each other's hands and pressed their foreheads together, and I felt, looking at them, that even if they were absurd, how much more absurd was I? A grown woman resentful of another grown woman who had done, after all, so much for me, so much for herself, and yes, for her people, and all, as she rightly said, from nothing at all. Was I feeling sorry for myself because I had no dowry? And when I looked up from the joint I was rolling, it seemed my mother had read my mind. "But don't you realize how incredibly lucky you are," she said, "to be alive at this moment? People like us, we can't be nostalgic. We've no home in the past. Nostalgia is a luxury. For our people, the time is now." I lit my joint, poured myself another finger of rum, and listened with my head bowed while the ducks quacked and my mother speechified, until it got late and her lover put a hand softly to her cheek, and I saw it was time to get the last train. In late July, I moved back to London, not to my mother's, but to my father's. I offered to sleep in the living room, but he wouldn't have it. He said if I slept there, the noise of him leaving for his rounds each morning would wake me, and I quickly accepted this logic and let him fold himself into the sofa. In return, I felt I'd really better find a job. My father truly did believe in the nobility of labour. He'd staked his life on it, and he made me ashamed to be idle. Sometimes, unable to go back to sleep after hearing him creep out of the door, I would sit up in bed and think about all this work, both my father's and his people's, going back many generations. Labour without education, labour usually without craft or skill, some of it honest and some of it crooked, but all of it leading somehow to my own present state of laziness. When I was quite young, 8 or 9, my father had shown me his father's birth certificate and the professions of his grandparents stated upon it, rag boiler and rag cutter, and this, I was meant to understand, was the proof that his tribe had always been defined by their labour. whether they wanted to be or not. The importance of labour was a view he held as strongly as my mother held her belief that the definitions that really mattered were culture and colour. Our people. Our people. I thought of how readily we'd all used the phrase, a few weeks earlier, on that beautiful June night at the noted activists, sitting drinking rum, admiring families of fat ducks, their heads turned inwards, their bills nestled into the feathers of their own bodies, roosting along the bank of the pond. Our people. Our people. And now, lying in the funk of my father's bed, turning the phrase over in my mind, for lack of anything better to do, it reminded me of the overlapping quack and babble of those birds, repeating over and over the same curious message, delivered from their own bills into their own feathers. I am a duck. I am a duck. 4. Stepping out of a bush taxi, after several months' absence, I spotted Fern standing by the side of the road, apparently waiting for me, right on time, as if there were a bus stop and a timetable. I was happy to see him. But he proved to be not in the mood for greetings or pleasantries, falling in step with me and immediately launching into a low-voiced debriefing, so that before I'd even reached Howard's door, I, too, was burdened with the rumour presently gripping the village. That Amy was in the process of organising a visa, that Lamin would soon move permanently to New York. Well, is it the case? I told him the truth. I didn't know and didn't want to know. I'd had an exhausting time in London, holding Amy's hand through a difficult winter, personally and professionally, and I was feeling, as a consequence, particularly averse to her brand of personal drama. The album she'd spent a grim British January and February recording, which should have been released about now, had instead been abandoned, the consequence of a brief, ugly affair with her young producer, who then took his songs with him. Only a few years earlier, a breakup like this would have been only a minor setback to Amy, hardly worth half a day in bed watching old episodes of long-forgotten Aussie soaps, The Flying Doctors, The Sullivans, something she did in moments of extreme vulnerability. But I had noticed a change in her. Her personal armour was no longer what it once was. Leaving and being left, his operations now affected her far more deeply. They were no longer water off a duck's back to her. She was actually wounded, and took no meetings with anyone except Judy for almost a month, barely leaving the house and asking me several times to sleep in her room, just by her bed, on the floor, as she did not want to be alone. During this period of purdah, I had assumed, for better or worse, that nobody was closer to her than me. Listening to Fern, my first feeling was that I had been betrayed, but the more I considered it, I saw that this was not quite right. It was not deceit, but a form of mental separation. I was comfort and company for her in a stalled moment, while, in another compartment of her heart, she was busily planning for the future, with Lamin, and Judy was her co-conspirator in that. Instead of being annoyed at Amy, I found myself frustrated by Fern. He was trying to get me involved, but I didn't want any part of it. It was inconvenient for me. I had my trip already planned out, and the more Fern spoke, the further I saw the itinerary plotted in my head slipping away from me. A visit to Kunta Kinte Island, a few afternoons at the beach, two nights in one of the fancy hotels in town. Amy gave me almost no annual leave. I had to be resourceful, stealing holidays where I could. Okay, but why not take Lamin with you? He'll talk to you. With me, he is like a clam. To the hotel? Fern, no, terrible idea. Well, on your trip, then. You cannot go out there by yourself anyway. You'll never find it. I gave in. When I told Lamin, he was happy. Not about visiting the island itself, I suspected, but because of the opportunity to escape the classroom and spend an afternoon negotiating with his friend Lolu, a cab driver, over the round-trip price. Lolu's afro had been cut into a Mohican, tinged to orange, and he wore a thick belt with a big silver buckle that read, Boy Toy. They appeared to negotiate all the way there, a two-hour journey filled with laughter and debate in the front seat, Lolu's deafening reggae music, many phone calls. I sat in the back, with little more wall-off than I'd had before, watching the bush go by, spotting the odd silver-grey monkey and ever more isolated settlements of people. You couldn't even call them villages, just two or three huts together, and then nothing again for another 10 miles. I remember in particular two barefoot girl children walking by the road, hand in hand. They looked like best friends. They waved at me and I waved back. There was nothing and no one around them. They were out on the edge of the world, or off the world I knew, and watching them, I realized it was very hard, almost impossible, for me to imagine what time felt like for them, out here. I could remember being their age, of course, holding hands with Tracy, and how we had considered ourselves 80s kids, more savvy than our parents, far more modern. We thought we were products of a particular moment, because as well as our old musicals, we liked things like Ghostbusters and Dallas and Lollipop Flutes. We felt we had our place in time. What person on earth doesn't feel this way? Yet when I waved at those two girls, I noticed I couldn't rid myself of the idea that they were timeless symbols of girlhood or of childish friendship. I knew it couldn't possibly be the case, but I had no other way to think of them. The road ended finally at the river. We got out and walked up to a 30-foot concrete statue of a stick man who stood facing the river. He had the whole of planet Earth for a head and was yanking his stick arms free from slavery's chains. A lone 19th-century cannon, the red brick shell of an original trading post, a small slavery museum built in 1992, and a desolate cafe completed what a desperate guide with a few teeth described as the Welcome Center. Behind us, a village of broken-down shacks, poorer by many orders of magnitude than the one we had come from, stubbornly faced the old trading post, as if hoping it might reopen. A crowd of children sat watching our arrival, but when I waved to them, our guide told me off. "They are not allowed to come any closer. They beg for money. They bother you tourists. The government has chosen us as official guides so that you are not bothered by them." About a mile across the river, I could see the island itself, a small, rocky outcrop with the picturesque ruins of barracks upon it. All I wanted was a minute's quiet to contemplate where I was and what, if anything, it meant. Here and there, between the triangle of cafe, slave statue, and watching children, I could see and hear groups of tourists, a solemn black British family, some enthusiastic African-American teenagers, a couple of white Dutch women, both already freely weeping, who were all trying to do the same, and likewise enduring a recited lecture from one of the official government guides in their ragged blue T-shirts, or having menus thrust into their hands from the cafe, or haggling with boatmen eager to take them across to see the prison cells of their ancestors. I saw I was lucky to have Lamin. While he engaged in his favourite activity, intense, whispered financial negotiation with several parties at once, I was free to wander over to the cannon, to sit astride it, and look out over the water. I tried to put myself in a meditative frame of mind, to picture the ships in the water, the human property walking up the gangplanks, the brave few who took their chances and leapt into the water in a doomed attempt to swim to shore. But every image had a cartoon thinness to it, and felt no closer to reality than the mural on the side of the museum that showed a strapping, naked Mandinka family in neck chains being chased out of the bush by an evil Dutchman, as if they had been trapped like prey by a hunter rather than sold like grain by their chief. All paths led back there, my mother had always told me. But now that I was here, in this storied corner of the continent, I experienced it not as an exceptional place, but as an example of a general rule. Power had preyed on weakness here. All kinds of power. Local, racial, tribal, royal, national, global, economic. On all kinds of weakness, stopping at nothing, not even at the smallest girl child. But power does that everywhere. The world is saturated in blood. Every tribe has their blood-soaked legacy. Here was mine. I waited for whatever cathartic feeling people hope to experience in such places, but I couldn't make myself believe the pain of my tribe was uniquely gathered here, in this place. The pain was too obviously everywhere. This just happened to be where they'd placed the monument. I gave up and went in search of Lamin. He was leaning against the statue on his new phone, a fancy-looking BlackBerry, with a dozy look on his face, a big, foolish smile, and when he saw me coming, he shut it off without saying goodbye. "Who was that?" "And so, if you are ready, whispered Lamon, wedging the huge thing into his back pocket. This man will now take us across. We shared a narrow boat with the black British family. They tried to strike up conversation with the guide concerning how far it was from the island to the mainland, and whether any man, never mind one in chains, could conceivably swim through these fast-moving currents. The guide listened to them talk, but looked so tired, the whites of his eyes obscured by the sheer number of broken blood vessels, and did not seem overly interested in hypotheticals. He repeated his mantra, "If a man reached the shore, he was given his freedom." On the island we shuffled around the ruin, and then queued to enter the last resort, a small underground room, 10x4, where the most rebellious men like Kunta were held. Imagine! Everybody kept saying this to each other, and I did try to imagine being brought down here, but knew instinctively I was not the rebellious type, not likely to be one of Kunta's tribe. Few people are. My mother I could certainly imagine down here, and Tracy, too. And Amy. She was in her way another of the breed. But not me. Unsure what to do with myself, I reached out to grasp an iron hoop in the wall to which these most rebellious had been chained at the neck.
Makes you want to cry, doesn't it?
Said the mother of the British family, and I felt it really should. But when I looked away from her in preparation, upwards to the tiny window, I found the government guide laid out on his belly, his three-toothed mouth blocking almost all of the available light.
"You will now feel the pain," he explained through the bars. "And you will need a minute alone. I will meet you outside after you have felt the pain."
On the boat back, I asked Lamon what it was he and Amy had to talk about so often. He was sitting on the thwart of the boat and straightened his back, lifted his chin. "She thinks I am a good dancer." "Does she?" "I have taught her many moves she didn't know. On the computer. I demonstrate our local steps. She says she will use them in her performances." "I see. And does she ever talk about you coming to America or England?"
"It is all in the hands of God," he said, casting an anxious eye over the other passengers.
"Yes, and the Foreign Office." Lolu, who had been waiting patiently in his cab, drove up to the shoreline as we approached and opened the car door, apparently intending to take me straight from the water to the car, another 2-hour ride without lunch. "But Lamon, I have to eat." I noticed he'd been clutching the cafe's laminated menu throughout our visit to the island, and now he showed it to me, the vital, clinching piece of evidence in a courtroom drama.
"This is too much money for lunch. Howell will make us lunch back home."
"I'll pay for lunch. It's like £3 a head. I promise you, Lamon, it's not too much for me." An argument ensued between Lamon and Lolu, which, I was pleased to see, Lamon appeared to lose. Lolu put his hands on his buckle like a triumphant cowboy, closed the door of his car, and rolled it back up the hill.
"It's too much," said Lamon again, sighing hugely, but I followed Lolu and Lamon followed me.
We sat at one of the picnic tables and ate fish in foil with rice. I listened to the talk at the neighboring tables, strange, uneven conversations that could not decide what they were. The heavy reflections of visitors to a historical trauma, or the light cocktail chatter of people on their beach holiday. A tall, sun-ravaged white woman, in her 70s at least, sat alone at a table at the back, surrounded by piles of folded printed cloth, drums and statues, T-shirts that said, "Never Again," other local merchandise. No one came near her stall or looked likely to buy anything, and after a while she stood up and began passing from table to table, welcoming guests, asking them where they were staying, where they were from. I was hoping we would have finished eating before she reached our table, but Lamon was a painfully slow eater, and she caught us. And when she heard that I was not from any hotel, and not an aid worker, and not a missionary, she took a special interest and sat down with us, too close to Lolu, who hunched over his fish and wouldn't look at her.
"Which village did you say?"
she asked, although I hadn't. But now Lamon told her before I had an opportunity to be vague. The penny dropped.
"Oh, but you're involved with the school. Of course. Well, I know people say the most awful things about that woman, but I really love her. I admire her, honestly. I'm actually an American, too, originally, she said, and I wondered how she thought anyone could be uncertain on this point. Normally, I don't care for Americans in general, but she's the kind with a passport, if you know what I mean. I really find her so curious and passionate, and it's a great thing for the country, all the publicity she brings. Oh, Australian. Well, either way, she's a woman after my own heart, and adventurous. Although, of course, I came here for love, not charity. The charity came afterwards in my case.
She touched her heart, which was half exposed in a multicolored spaghetti strap dress with a frighteningly deep décolletage. Her breasts were long, red, and creppy. I was absolutely determined not to ask her whose love she had come here for, nor to what good deeds this act had ultimately led, but sensing my resistance, she decided, with an old woman's prerogative, to tell me anyway.
I was just like these people, just here on holiday. I didn't mean to fall in love with a boy half my age.
She winked at me.
And that was 20 years ago. But it was much, much more than a holiday romance, you see. Together, we built all this.
She looked around proudly at this great monument to love, a tin-roofed cafe with 4 tables and 3 items on the menu.
I'm not a rich woman. I was really just a humble yoga teacher. But these people in Berkeley, you only have to say to them, look, this is the situation. These people are in desperate need. And I could tell you, you'd be surprised. These people really just go for it. They really do. Just about everybody wanted to pitch in. When you explain what a dollar does here, when you explain how far the dollar's gonna go, oh, people can't believe it. Now, sadly, my own children from my first marriage, they have not been so supportive. Yes, sometimes it's the strangers that sustain you, but I always say to the people here, don't believe everything you hear, please, because not all Americans are bad news, not at all. There's a big difference between the folks in Berkeley and the folks in Fort Worth, if you catch my meaning. I was born in Texas to Christian folks, and when I was young, America was a pretty hard place for me because I was a free spirit, and I just couldn't find my place. But I guess it suits me a little more now.
But you live here with your husband? Asked Lamin. She smiled, but did not seem overly enthralled by the question.
In the summers. The winters I spend in Berkeley.
And he goes then with you? Asked Lamin. I had the sense he was conducting subtle research.
No. No. He stays here. He has a lot to do here all year round. He's the big man round here, and I guess you could say I'm the big woman back there. So it works very well for us.
I thought of that layer of girlish illusion Amy's new mother friends all appeared to have lost, a kind of light in their eyes that had gone out, notwithstanding even their own celebrity and wealth. And then I looked into the wide, blue, half-crazed eyes of this woman and saw a total excavation. It hardly seemed possible someone could have had so many layers stripped from her and still be able to play her part. 5. After graduation, from the base of my father's flat, I applied for every entry-level media job I could think of, leaving my begging letters on the kitchen counter each night for him to post in the morning. But a month passed, and nothing. I knew my father's relationship to these letters was complicated. Good news for me meant bad news for him, meant me moving out, and sometimes I had paranoid fantasies that he never posted them at all, just deposited them in the bin at the end of our street. I considered what my mother had always said about his lack of ambition, against which accusation I had always angrily defended him, and was forced to admit that I could see now what she was getting at. Nothing made him jollier than my Uncle Lambert's occasional Sunday visits, when we would all three plant ourselves in deck chairs on the ivy-covered flat roof of my father's downstairs neighbours and smoke weed, eat the homemade fish dumplings that were Lambert's excuse for being 2 to 3 hours late, Listen to the World Service and watch the Jubilee line trains rise up every 8 to 10 minutes from the bowels of the earth. Now, this is the life, love, wouldn't you say? No more do this, don't do that. Just us all friends together. Equals. Eh, Lambert? When you get to be friends with your own kid. This is the life, isn't it? Was it? I didn't remember him ever taking on the parental power dynamic he claimed now to be sloughing off. He'd never said, do this, don't do that. Love and latitude, that was all he'd ever offered me. And where did it lead? Was I going to enter early stoned retirement with Lambert? Not knowing what else to do, I went back to a terrible job, one I'd had the first summer of college, in a pizza place in Kensal Rise. It was run by a ridiculous Iranian called Barham, very tall and thin, who considered himself, despite his surroundings, to be a man of quality. He liked to wear a long, chic, camel-coloured coat, no matter the weather, often hanging it from his shoulders like an Italian baron, and he called his dump a restaurant, though the premises were the size of a small family bathroom, occupying a corner plot of scrubland wedged between the bus terminal and the railway. No one ever came in to eat. They ordered delivery or took their food home. I used to stand at the counter and watch the mice dart across the linoleum. There was a single table at which theoretically a customer was free to dine, but in reality, Barham occupied this table all day long and half the night. He had troubles at home. A wife and 3 difficult unmarried daughters, and we suspected he preferred our company to this family, or at least preferred shouting at us to arguing with them. At work, his day was not strenuous. He passed it commenting on whatever was on the TV in the top left corner of the place, or else verbally abusing us, his staff, from this sitting position. He was in a rage all the time about everything. A flamboyant, comic rage that expressed itself in a constant obscene teasing of everyone around him, racial, sexual, political, religious teasing, and which almost every day resulted in a lost customer or employee or friend, and so came to seem to me not so much offensive as poignantly self-defeating. Anyway, it was the only entertainment on offer. But the first time I walked in there, aged 19, I was not abused. No, I was greeted in what I later understood to be Farsi, and so effusively that I really felt I got a sense of what he was saying. How young I was, and lovely, and clearly smart. Was it true I was in college? But how proud my mother must be. He stood up and held me by the chin, turning my face one way and then the other, smiling. But when I replied in English, he frowned and looked closely, critically, at the red bandana covering my hair. I thought it would be welcome in a place of food production. And a few moments later, after we had established that despite my Persian nose, I was not Persian, not even a little bit, nor Egyptian, nor Moroccan, nor an Arab of any kind, I made the mistake of speaking the name of my mother's island, and all friendliness vanished. I was directed to the counter, where my job was to answer the phone, take orders to the kitchen, and organize the delivery boys. My most important task was attending to a beloved project of his, the banned customers list. He had taken the trouble to write this list out on a long roll of paper and stuck it up on the wall behind my counter, sometimes with Polaroids attached. "Mostly your people," he pointed out to me casually on my second day. "They don't pay, or they fight, or they drug dealers. Don't give me face. How you be offended, you know, is truth." I couldn't afford to be offended. I was determined to last those 3 summer months, long enough to put something towards a deposit so I could start renting the moment I graduated. But the tennis was on, and this made everything impossible. A Somali delivery boy and I were following it avidly, and Barham, who would normally also follow the tennis, he considered sport the purest manifestation of his sociological theories, was this year in a fury about it, and in a fury with us for enjoying it. And each time he caught us watching it, he became more enraged, his sense of order having been deeply disturbed by the failure of Brian Shelton to drop out in the first round. "Why you follow him? Huh? Huh? 'Cause he's one of you?" He was jabbing his finger into the narrow chest of the Somali delivery boy, Anwar, who had a great luminosity of spirit, a notable capacity for joy, despite nothing in his life seeming to provide just cause for it. and whose response now was to clap his hands and grin from ear to ear. "Yeah, man, we for Brian."
"You are idiot, this we know," said Barham,
and then turned to me behind the counter.
"But you are smart, and this makes you more idiot."
When I said nothing, he came right up to me and slammed his fist on the counter.
"This man Shelton, he won't win, he can't."
He win," cried Anwar.
Barham picked up the remote and turned down the TV so he could get himself heard all the way to the back, even as far as the Congolese woman scrubbing the sides of the pizza oven.
"Tennis not black game. You must understand every people have their game."
"What's your game?" I asked, genuinely curious, and Barham pulled himself up very tall and proud in his seat.
"Polo."
The kitchen exploded in laughter.
"Fuck all your sons of bitches."
Hysteria. As it happened, I hadn't been following Shelton, had never heard of him, really, before Anwar pointed him out. But now I did follow him, along with Anwar, I became his number one fan. I bought little American flags to work on the days of his games, and made sure to send out, on these occasions, all the other delivery boys, except Anwar. Together, we cheered Shelton, danced around the place at each successful point, and as he won one match and then another, we began to feel like we, with our dancing and whooping, were the ones propelling him forward, and that without us he'd be done for. At times, Barham behaved as if he believed this, too, as if we were performing some ancient African voodoo rite. Yes, somehow we put a spell on Barham just as much as Shelton. And as the days of the tournament passed, and Shelton still refused to be knocked out, I saw Barham's many other pressing worries. The business, his difficult wife, the stressful search for suitors for his daughters, all slip away, until his sole preoccupation was ensuring we did not cheer for Brian Shelton, and that Shelton himself did not get to the Wimbledon final. One morning, halfway through the tournament, I was standing bored at the counter when I saw Anwar on his bike, riding up the pavement towards us at great speed, then brake haphazardly, leap off, and rush up to my counter with his fist in his mouth and a smile he could barely control. He slapped a copy of the Daily Mirror in front of me, pointed to a column in the sports pages, and said,
"Arab!"
We couldn't believe it. His name was Karim Alami. He was from Morocco, and he was seeded even lower than Shelton. Their match was to start at 2. Barham arrived at 1. There was a great feeling of anxiety and anticipation in the place. Delivery boys who were not meant to come till 5 came early, and the Congolese cleaner began working through the back of the kitchen at unprecedented speed, in the hope she would reach front of house, and therefore the television, by the time the game began. That match went 5 rounds. Shelton started strong, and at various points in the first set, Barham was reduced to standing on a chair and screaming. When the first set ended 6-3 to Shelton, Barham jumped off his chair and walked straight out of the building. We looked at each other. Was this victory? 5 minutes later, he sloped back in with a packet of Gauloises in hand, retrieved from his car, and began chain-smoking with his head down. But in the second set, things began to look a little better for Karim, and Barham sat up straight as straight, then stood, and began pacing in a circular way around the small space, offering his own commentary, which had as much to do with eugenics as backhands and lobs and double faults, and as we reached a tiebreak, he became increasingly fluent in his lecture, waving his cigarette around in his hand, ever more confident in his English. "The black man," he informed us, "he is instinct, he is moving body, he is strong, and he is music. Yes, of course, and he is rhythm, everybody know this. And he is speed, and this is beautiful, maybe, yes, but let me tell you, tennis is game of the mind. The mind. The black man can be good strength, good muscle, he can hit ball hard, but Karim, he is like me, he think 1-2 step in front, he have Arab mind is complicated machine, delicate. We invent mathematics, we invent astronomy, subtle people, 2 steps ahead. Your Brian now, he is lost." But he was not lost. He took the set 7-5. And Anwar took the broom away from the Congolese cleaner, whose name I did not know, whose name no one ever thought to ask, and made her dance with him to some high life he had going on the transistor radio he carried everywhere. In the next set, Shelton collapsed, 1-6. Barham was exultant. "Wherever you go in the world," he told Anwar, "you people at bottom, sometimes a top white man, Jew, Arab, Chinese, Japan, depends, but your people always they lose." By the time the fourth set started, we had stopped pretending to be a pizza place. The phone rang and no one answered. The oven was empty and everybody was crammed into the small space at the front. I sat on the counter with Anwar, our nervous legs kicking the cheap MDF panels until they rattled. We watched these two players, in truth almost perfectly matched, battling towards an elongated, excruciating tiebreak that Shelton then lost 6-7. Anwar burst into bitter tears.
"But Anwar, little friend, he have one more set,"
explained the kindly Bosnian chef, and Anwar was as grateful as the man sitting in an electric chair who's just spotted the governor through the plexiglass running down the hall. The final set was quick. 6-2. Game, set, match. Shelton. Anwar turned his radio up full blast, and every kind of dance burst forth from me. Winding, stomping, shuffling. I even did the shim-sham. Barham accused us all of having sex with our mothers and stormed out. About an hour later, he returned. It was the early evening rush when mothers decide they can't face cooking dinner and all-day tokers suddenly realize they haven't eaten since breakfast. I was harried on the phone, trying, as usual, to pass many different kinds of pidgin English, both on the phones and among our own delivery crew, when Barham walked up to me and put the evening paper in my face. He pointed to a picture of Shelton, his arm swung high in preparation for one of his forceful serves, ball in the air before him, paused at the moment of connection. I cupped the phone receiver with a hand. What? I'm working.
"Look close. Not black. Brown, like you."
"I'm working."
"Probably he is half-half, like you. So this explains."
I looked not at Shelton, but at Barham, very closely. He smiled.
"Half winner," he said.
I put the phone down, took my apron off, and walked out. I don't know how Tracy found out I was back working at Barham's. I didn't want anyone to know. I could hardly face the truth of it myself. Probably she simply spotted me through the glass. When she walked in, one steamy afternoon in late August, she caused a sensation in her skin-tight leggings and navel-skimming crop-top. I noticed her clothes had not changed with the times, that they had no need of change. She did not struggle, as I did, as most women I knew did, to find ways to dress her body in the symbols, shapes, and signs of the age. It was as if she were above all that. Timeless. She was always dressed for a dance rehearsal, and always looked wonderful that way. Anwar and the rest of the boys, waiting outside on their bikes, took a good long time over the front view and then repositioned themselves to get what Italians call the B-side. When she leant over the counter to speak to me, I saw one of them cover his eyes as if in physical pain.
"Good to see you. How was the seaside?"
She smirked, confirming the sense I already had that my college life had been some kind of local joke, a poor attempt at playing a role outside of my range, one that had not come off.
"See your mum about? She's everywhere these days."
"Yes, I'm glad to be back, I think." "You look great. Are you working?"
"Oh, I'm doing all sorts. Got big news. When'd you get off?"
"I just started." "So what about tomorrow?" Barham sidled up to us, and in his most courtly manner inquired whether Tracy happened to be Persian. We met up the following evening in a local pub that we had always known as Irish, but which now was neither Irish nor anything else. The old booths had gone and been replaced by a great many sofas and wing-back chairs from different historical eras, covered in clashing prints and scattered around the place like a stage set recently dismantled. Purple flock wallpaper was plastered above the chimney breast, and many poorly stuffed woodland creatures, arrested in the act of leaping or crouching, were encased in glass bell jars and had been placed on high shelves, looking over mine and Tracy's reunion with their wonky glass eyes. I broke the gaze of a petrified squirrel to greet Tracy, who was returning from the bar with two white wines in her hands and a powerful look of disgust on her face. 7 quid? What fuckery is this?
We could go somewhere else. She screwed up her nose.
No, that's what they want. We were born here. Drink slowly.
We could never drink slowly. We kept going, on Tracy's credit card, reminiscing and laughing. Laughing harder than I had in all 3 years of college. Taking each other back to Miss Isabel's yellow shoes, to my mother's clay pit, to the history of dance, through all of it. Even things I never thought we would ever be able to laugh at together. Louis dancing with Michael Jackson, my own royal ballet delusion. Feeling bold, I asked after her father. She stopped laughing.
Still over there. Got a whole bunch of out-the-house children now, so I'm told.
Her ever-expressive face turned pensive, and then took on that look of utter icy coldness I remembered so well from childhood. I considered telling her about what I had seen years before in Kentish Town, but that coldness stopped up the sentence in my mouth.
What about your old man? I haven't seen him for time.
Believe it or not, I think he's still in love with my mother.
That's nice, she said,
but that look stayed on her face. She was staring past me at the squirrel.
That's nice,
she said once again. I could see we had got to the end of reminiscence, that it was properly time to venture into the present day. I could guess how easily Tracy's news would outstrip whatever I had to offer. And so it did. She had a part on a West End stage. It was in a revival of one of our favourite shows, Guys and Dolls, and she was playing Hot Box Girl No. 1, which I remembered was not a huge role. In the film she had no name of her own and spoke only 4 or 5 lines, but all the same she was present a lot, singing and dancing in the Hot Box Club, or else trailing Adelaide, whose best friend she's meant to be. Tracy would get to do Take Back Your Mink, a song we did as children, brandishing a mangy-looking pair of feather boas, and she'd wear lace corsets and real satin gowns, and have her hair set and curled.
We're in proper dress rehearsal now. They use flat irons on me every night. It's killing me.
She touched her hairline, and underneath the wax that had been used to slick it down, I saw that indeed it was already frayed and patchy. She'd got her boast out of the way. In its aftermath, though, she struck me as vulnerable and defensive, and I had the sense that I had not reacted quite as she'd wanted. Perhaps she had really imagined that a 21-year-old college graduate would hear her good news and collapse weeping on the floor. She picked up her wine and drained it. She asked, at last, about my life. I took a deep breath and repeated the sorts of things I said to my mother. Only a stopgap, waiting to hear of other opportunities, staying at my dad's temporarily, rent being high, no relationship, but then relationships were so complicated, not what I needed right now, and I wanted time to work on my own.
Right, right, right. But you can't keep working for pizza, cunt, can you? You need a plan.
I nodded and waited. Relief came over me. Familiar, though I had not felt it for a long time, and I connected it to being taken in hand by Tracy, to having decisions removed from me and replaced instead by her will, her intentions. Hadn't Tracy always known what games to play, what stories to tell, what beat to choose, what move to make to it?
Look, I know you're a big woman now, she said, confidingly, leaning back in her chair, with her feet pointed below, creating a beautiful vertical line from her knees to her toes. It's none of my business, but if you need something... They're looking for stage hands right now. You could try for it. I could put a good word in. It's just 4 months, but it's better than fuck all.
I don't know anything about theatre. I've got no experience.
Oh my gosh, said Tracy, shaking her head at me, standing up to get another round in. Just lie.
6. I assumed my questioning of Lamin had got back to Amy, because on the day of my departure from the Coco Ocean Hotel, the front desk called up to my room to tell me they had a message for me, and when I opened the white envelope, I found this note. Jet unavailable. You'll have to fly commercial. Save receipts. Judy. I was being punished. At first I thought it was funny that Amy's idea of punishment was flying commercial, but when I got to the airport, I was surprised by how much I had in fact forgotten. The waiting. The queuing. The submitting to irrational instructions. Every aspect of it,
The presence of so many other people, the brusqueness of the staff, even the immutable flight time on the screens in the waiting room, it all felt like an affront. My seat was next to two truck drivers from Huddersfield. They were in their 60s and had travelled together. They loved it here. They'd come every year if they could afford it. After lunch, they started in on some little bottles of Bailey's and compared notes on their girls. They both wore wedding rings, half embedded in their fat, hairy fingers. I had my earphones in by then. They probably thought I couldn't hear them.
My one said to me she were 20, but her cousin, he's a waiter there too, he told me she was 17. Wise beyond her years, though.
He had hardened egg yolk down his T-shirt. His friend had yellow teeth and bloody gums. They had 7 days of holiday in any calendar year. The man with the yellow teeth had worked double shifts for 3 months simply to afford this long weekend with his girl in Banjul. I had murderous fantasies of taking my serrated plastic knife, drawing it across each of their throats. But the longer I listened, the sadder the whole thing seemed.
I said to her, "Don't you want to come to England?" And she basically says to me, "No fear, love. She wants us to build a house in Wasu, wherever the fuck that is. They're no fools, these girls. Realistic. Pound goes a lot bloody further out here than it does back home. It's like the missus moaning about she wants to go to Spain. I said to her, "You're living in the past, love. You know how much Spain is these days."
One kind of weakness feeding on another. A few days later, I was back at work. I kept waiting for a formal meeting or a debrief, but it was as if I hadn't made the visit at all. Nobody mentioned my trip, and in itself that was not so unusual. Many other things were going on at the time. A new album, a new tour. But in the subtle way of the best bullies, Judy and Amy strove to freeze me out of all important decisions while simultaneously ensuring that nothing they said or did could be explicitly interpreted as punishment or retribution. We were preparing for our autumn transition to New York, a period in which Amy and I were usually glued to each other, but now I hardly saw her, and for 2 weeks I was given the kind of grunt work more appropriate to the housekeepers. I was on the phone to freight companies, I was cataloguing shoes, I accompanied the children to their yoga class. I cornered Judy about it early one Saturday morning. Amy was in the basement, working out, the children were watching their 1 hour of weekly television. I trawled the house and found Judy sitting in the library with her feet up on the baize desk, painting her toenails in a terrible fuchsia, a white foam wedge stuck between each long toe. She didn't look up until I'd finished speaking.
"Yeah, well, hate to break it to you, love, but Amy doesn't give a flying fuck what you think of a private life."
"I'm trying to look out for her interests. That's my job as a friend."
"No, love, not accurate. Your job is personal assistant."
"I've been here 9 years.
"And I've been here 29.
She swung her feet round and placed them in a black box on the floor that glowed purple.
"I've seen a lot of these assistants come and go, but Christ, none of them has been as delusional as you."
"Isn't it true? Isn't she trying to get him a visa?"
"I'm not discussing that with you.
Judy, I spent today mainly working for the dog. I have a degree. Don't tell me I'm not being punished."
Judy pulled her fringe back with both hands. "First of all, don't be so bloody melodramatic. What you are doing is working. Whatever you may think, Chook, your job is not, and has never been, best mate. You're her assistant. You always have been. But recently, you seem to have forgotten that, and it's about time you were reminded. So that's our first issue. Number two. If she wants to bring him over here, if she wants to marry him or dance with him on top of big fucking Ben, that is no concern of yours. You're very far out of your area."
Judy sighed and looked down at her toes.
"And the funny part of it is, she's not even pissed off with you about the boy. It's not even about the bloody boy."
"What then? You've spoken to your mum recently?" This question made me violently blush. How long had it been? A month? Two? Parliament was in session, she was busy, and if she wanted me, she knew where I was. I was going through these justifications in my head for a long moment before it occurred to me to wonder why Judy was interested.
"Well, maybe you should. She's making life difficult for us right now, and I don't really know why. Would help if you could find out. My mother.
I mean, there's a million issues in this little shithole of an island you call a country. Literally a million.
She wants to talk about dictatorships in West Africa, said Judy, using finger quotes. British complicity with dictatorships in West Africa. She's on the TV. She's writing the op-eds. She's standing up in bloody Prime Minister's question tea hour or whatever the fuck it is you people call it. She's got a bee in a bonnet about it. Fine.
Well, that's not my problem. What DFID does, what the IMF does, that's out of my area. Amy, however, is my area. And yours. We're in partnership with this crazy bloody president, and if you go and ask your beloved Fern, he'll tell you what a tightrope we're walking right now. Believe me, love, if His Highness for Life, the almighty King of Kings, doesn't want us in his country, we are out of there in two shakes of a lamb's tail. The school gets fucked. Everybody gets fucked. Now, I know you have a degree. You've told me many, many times. Is it in international development? No, I didn't think so. And I'm sure your big mouth mother out there on the back benches probably thinks she's being helpful too. God knows. But you know what she's actually doing? Hurting the people she claims to want to help and pissing on those of us who are trying to make some kind of difference out there. Biting the hand. Seems to run in the family.
I sat down on the chaise longue.
Jesus, don't you ever read the papers? Asked Judy.
3 days after that conversation, we flew to New York. I left messages with my mother, texted her, emailed her, but she didn't call me till the end of the following week, and with the extraordinary timing of mothers, chose 2:30 p.m. on a Sunday, just as Jay's cake came out of the kitchens and streamers fell from the ceiling of the Rainbow Room, and 200 guests sang Happy Birthday, accompanied by violinists from the string section of the New York Philharmonic.
What's all that noise? Where are you?
I opened the sliding doors to the terrace and shut them behind me. It's Jay's birthday. He's 9 today. I'm at the top of the Rockefeller.
Look, I don't want to have an argument with you on the phone, said my mother, sounding very much like she wanted to have an argument on the phone. I've read your emails. I understand your position. But I hope you understand that I don't work for that woman. Or for you, actually. I work for the British people. And if I've developed an interest in that region, if I've become increasingly concerned...
Yes, but Mum, can't you become increasingly concerned about something else?
Doesn't it matter to you who your partners are in this project? I know you, darling, and I know you're not a mercenary. I know you have ideals. I raised you, for God's sake, so I know. I've been into it very deeply, Miriam, too, and we've come to the conclusion that at this point the human rights issue is really becoming untenable. I wish it wasn't for your sake, but there it is.
Darling, don't you want to know?
Mum, sorry, I'll call you back. I have to go.
Fern, in an ill-fitting, clearly rented suit, a little too short at the ankles, was walking towards me, waving goofily, and I don't think I realized how far out of the loop I had fallen until that moment. To me, he was a cut-out figure pasted in the wrong photograph, in the wrong moment. He smiled, pulled open the sliding doors, his head cocked to the side like a terrier.
Ah, but you look really beautiful.
Why didn't anyone tell me you were coming? Why didn't you? He drew a hand through curls half-tamed by cheap hair gel, and looked sheepish, a schoolboy caught out in a minor misdemeanor.
Well, I was on confidential business. It's ridiculous, but all the same, I couldn't tell you. I'm sorry. They wanted it kept quiet.
I looked over to where he was pointing and saw Lamin. He sat at the central table in a white suit, like the groom at a wedding, with Judy and Amy either side of him. Jesus Christ.
No, I don't think it was him. Not unless he works for the State Department.
He took a step forward and put his hands on the barrier wall.
But what a view this is!
The whole city lay before us. I set my back to it, turning to study Fern instead, to check on his reality, and then to watch Lamin accept a slice of cake from a passing waiter. I tried to account for the panic I felt. It was more than simply being kept in the dark. It was a rejection of the way I ordered my own reality. For in my mind, at that time, as perhaps it is for most young people, I was at the center of things, the only person in the world with true freedom. I moved from here to there, observing life as it presented itself to me. But everybody else in these scenes, all the subsidiary characters, belonged only in the compartments in which I had placed them. Fern eternally in the pink house, Lamin confined to the dusty paths of the village.